I'm your host, Lorena, and this is Conversations on Death. On today's episode, I spoke to Paul Gambino, who has been an avid collector of the bizarre for over 25 years. And the past 2 decades of his serious collecting have allowed Paul to gain the trust of some of the world's most prominent macabre collectors, which has led him to write these books that I'm going to share with you. One of them is called Morbid Curiosities, Collections of the Uncommon and the Bizarre. The other one is called Skulls, which is the one that I have. Skulls, Portraits of the Dead and the Stories They Tell. And another one that's super cool, Killer Collections, Dark Artifacts from True Crime. And in July of this year, he's going to have another book come out, which is titled The Art of Gothic Living, Dark Decor for the Modern Macabre. So this conversation kind of goes all over the place, but essentially we just have a really fascinating conversation about collecting, obviously, different collections and different collectors, because he's met hundreds of them in his 20 years in the industry and also through writing these books. Obviously, all these things are also connected to death, and we talk about the ethics behind collecting some of these things. And towards the end, there's a little something about my obsession with Elvis. So if you care to stick around, please do for that, and how all of that is even related to what we're talking about. I hope you enjoy and check out his books, because they're just absolutely fucking beautiful. So let's just get started and hear, how would you introduce yourself to our listeners and how you got started doing all the things that you do and your interests?
Well, I started out in magazines. I was the editor of a bunch of tattoo magazines for a very long time, Revel Ink, Urban Ink, Skin and Ink. And that actually enabled me to meet a lot of people, which really was a great segue for me. I would seek out people that I thought or genres that I thought were cool. And you were undoubtedly going to find people that were tattooed in that genre. So I was able to interview a lot of people that I wanted to, just based on, because I knew that that subculture, there would be tattooed people in it. that's not how I got into oddities, but that's how I got into photographing people with oddities. You know, I was always into oddities, but never thought about, you know, documenting these people or their collections. And then it was a natural segue. I had built up all these relationships with photographers all across the world. So I was able to document other people's stuff and it not become cost prohibitive. You know, that was the thing. Like, you're familiar with Morbid Curiosities, which is 90% in the States. Skulls, on the other hand, that book, Skulls, is really international. It's over 20 collectors all over the world. So that really would have been, if I didn't have connections or relationships with photographers throughout the world, that book wouldn't have been able to be done in a realistic budget. So that's not how my collecting started, but that's how the ability to do the book started, to do Morbid Curiosity, Skulls, Dark Interiors, and now most recently,
The Art of Gothic Living.
Isn't that funny that
I got you. Like,
yeah.
Now, you do a lot of work.
Yeah. You know, that's, it's awesome. So fun. Yeah, and it's interesting, because when I was younger and I would watch filmmakers and they would say, you just finished this film. And, you know, have you watched it? And what did you think of it? And they're like, oh, I haven't even watched it. And I guess you're like, you probably have that same experience too. You're so involved in a project and it becomes, and then as that one's winding down, you're already thinking of the next project. Mm-hmm. So you're so invested in the next project that it takes nothing away from the passion you had for the previous project, but you're on to the next project already. You know what I mean? And you're like, and what you wind up doing is, when you look at your past projects, you know, when you open the book or watch the film or look at your last podcast, you're not enjoying it. You're thinking, oh, shit, I messed this up. Oh, I could have done that better next time. Yep. You know, so maybe that's another reason why, you know, quote unquote, artists don't want to look back at their work, because they don't look at it as enjoyment. They look at it as too critical Oh my God. So it's like, it's just time to
1,000%. I recently started doing branding for businesses, and it's like in the moment I'm like, oh, this is amazing. Right. And literally the next day I'm like, okay, this sucks. What the fuck? And it's like the happy medium. It's like, when do I decide that this is done? And same thing with the podcast. Like, I edit them myself and I hate editing them. Like, I mean, not just because it's time consuming, but I don't like hearing my voice. I don't like hearing the stupid shit I say, you know, I hate it, but it is what it is. You know, people seem to enjoy it, so I guess I got to do it for the people. But yeah. I totally get that. So I want to hear a little bit more in a bit about more in depth about all of your books. But let's hear about how you got into being a collector, all the weird shit, essentially.
Yeah. And you know what, based on, you know, conversations on death being the title of your show, it's interesting how the title of your show being Conversations on Death, how the philosophy of what, why death is so important to so many people. I can't speak for everyone, but, my wife kind of summed it up for me. She said, I surround myself with death because it's a way for me to feel that I have some control over it, you know, and I don't, obviously you don't, and we don't. And I found that in a lot of collectors, that it is a sense of being able to kind of make sense of something that they can't make sense of, or make it tangible for something that's so kind of, you know, intangible. I was interviewed once by National Geographic, and the woman asked me a question that I should have really thought of. I don't know if the mic messed up when it did. It's a question that I should have really thought of when doing the book. And she said, you know, after looking at the book, it seems to be that the collectors are kind of grappling with religion and science. And when I did, I mean, when I looked at it, I was like, yeah, that is really what it is. It's like, and so many of the collectors, myself included, collect both religious artifacts and maybe very clinical, somewhat barbaric, medical devices, you know what I mean, that go again, you know, and you know, it's like trying to save life on a very earthly level, and then there's this whole admiration for spiritualism. Not that the people may not be spiritualists or spiritual, and so many of them love to say that they're not, and I don't know how much of that is true, you know. But there seems to be some kind of, now there are some people that have no purposely have no respect for religion, and it's part of their whole thing of, and I'll give you an example. In this book, in Dark Artifacts, one of the collectors said he collects serial killers is his big thing, and he's a very passionate crime artifact collector, in the fact that he only collects if he can meet the perpetrator. So, I mean, he's visited everybody, you know, obviously that's the cool. Mansions and stuff. Yeah. And that's the only way he'll get something, is if he meets them and gets it from them. And he has a lot of that stuff, and he's a lot of religion. And then he said to me something that was so poignant. Once again, you know, I grew up Catholic and everything like that. So, you know, how much faith I have, or how much I want to have, or how much, you know, is, you know, always like kind of fluctuates. But he said, oh, people ask me, well, why do you have so much religious artifacts if you collect crime? And he said, well, I would have to say that the Catholic Church is probably one of the biggest perpetrators of murder. You know what I mean? So yeah. It kind of, you know, there is this constant battle between religion and science, and, you know, what we know here and what's, you know, and you know, like we were saying, like in religions, and that kind of, you got to reel me in if I'm just like swerving too many places.
Please swerve. I swerve all the time. I love it. That's why it's a chill podcast. All good.
Okay. Yeah. Because right now it seems to be very popular, or starting to get popular, is, and how much credence you put on some of the pieces is haunted items is like huge now, you know, people saying this item is haunted, this item is haunted.
How do they like,
well, the provenance, yeah. And how, I know a collector down in New Orleans who I trust a lot in terms of, you know, obviously you have to go in, believing, you know what I mean? And so there's no way to prove it, but, Rick's stuff has such great storylines behind it, and he has so many pieces that, although he, you know, a lot of it is lore, it's still fascinating. And if you have 200 pieces that you claim are haunted, and one of them actually is, that's good. I mean, you know what I mean? You know, yeah. And that always happens when I would ask people. Like, I'd always ask people who, when doing any of the books, except for the crime, is, do you believe that your house is haunted? And 99 out of 100 people say, no, but I wish it was. You know what I mean? So, you know, it is definitely a different outlook. And so many of them had a very logical response to their house being haunted. Not so many of them, but enough had it that, you know, if it means that, you know, a couple spoons are going to fall out of my thing, you know, out of my closet, or this is going to move around a little bit, I'm fine with that. You know what I mean? There's not too many people being killed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe in the movies, but
people right, are right, playing, right. But not in real life.
Right. Not in real life, you know? So
this is, people that you've interviewed for your last book that you're mentioning?
No.
Let's talk a little bit, just to do a synopsis of each of the books, since we keep mentioning them.
Yeah, and it makes sense. There is a chronology. Because Morbid Curiosities, I was a collector, and I had befriended a lot of collectors, and it was like, oh, you know what? It really would be nice. You know, people's collections had grown to a point where, you know, they rival, like, you know, museum quality, a lot of them, you know? And I was like, all right, it's time to, you know, it'd be great to document it. And luckily I had friendships with some of the more high profile people, which gave me some credibility. So I started shooting those collections, and a lot of these people hadn't had their collections ever shot. You know, they were kind of private about it. And I had been at people's home shooting, when I would overhear somebody on the phone saying, yeah, he's here now. He's a cool guy. You can let him shoot your stuff. You know what I mean? You know, so that trust got built up in Morbid. And I purposed, there was two important factors in Morbid Curiosities and in any of my books. One is that the collector is equally as important as the collection, because otherwise it just becomes a catalog. You know, here's another thing, here's another thing, here's another thing. You know what I mean? And I fought with every publisher, and I've won it 3 out of 4. And that is a big portrait of the collector. You know, it's so much, I think it's so great to identify that collection with that collector. You know, because you have a mental image of what this person's going to look like. And then it wasn't like, oh, I promised to do this because, you know, I was thinking of doing, I never thought of doing it. And there was never to paint the collector as, oh, this guy's nuts or this girl's nuts. You know what I mean? You know, that wasn't the thing. It wasn't like how weird they were or how bizarre they were. And you really find out. I did a book on, believe it or not, the very first book I did was on scrapbooking. And it was supposed to be like the anti scrapbooking, my scrapbook. You know, I had like strippers in there and burlesque. Actually somebody scrapbooked the murder of a friend of theirs. So it was different. And but the scrapbooking community, believe it or not, they were brutal. They were really, you know, they were really not very nice to me. Maybe because they felt I was an outsider and I was trying to capitalize, which I really was, you know. Yeah. So I guess they had every right to be. So Morbid Curiosities comes about. It's a thing about looking at complete collections and the collectors. The book does very well. The publisher comes to me and says, you know what? One of the collectors in the book, who happens not to appear in Skulls, said, you should do a book primarily on Skulls. And that seemed natural because every collector has a skull. Every oddities collector has a skull. But I was like, okay, that's cool. I'm not a huge skull guy. I have skulls, but that's not my main thing. I was like, okay, but if we do this, it's not going to be everybody that has the most amount of skulls, because it's just as interesting or more so or equally as interesting for the person that has one skull. Like, why would you only have one skull? If you, you know, especially if you're not an oddities collector, how come you have a skull, you know? So there were a lot of people, not a lot of people, but there are some people in the book that have very few skulls or only one skull, to people that literally have hundreds, you know? And it was very important for me. Morbid Curiosity was easier to do in terms of, I didn't want the book to be, by the time you got to page 20, it's like, oh, here's another skull. Here's another skull. Here's another skull. You know, so I worked with Dan Howell a lot and a lot of other photographers who are, I always work with portrait photographers. So, you know, the whole idea was to shoot each skull with some, not to the point that it's like, you know, that they're too jarring, but that, okay, this is a series, this is a series, this is a series. So there isn't a redundancy, you know.
They're absolutely beautiful. I've never seen a collection of just such beautiful photographs. I mean, the entire book is like,
oh, you have skulls?
It's beautiful. Yeah, that's the one you gave me, actually.
Oh, I gave you
not
skulls.
Not the Morbid Curiosity.
Yeah. That was sold out. That's right. Okay, yeah. So, right. So you see what I'm glad you think that it was accomplished, that it is a different photograph every time. It's not just another skull, you know? So the segue from that was a little bit opportunistic. We go to Dark Artifacts, which is people who collect crime-related items. That obviously it was going to be a little bit tricky, because it is treading, you know, there's the whole victim situation, you know, you could be, you know, that, you know, so, and definitely that has to be taken into account. So, I picked very, very, very serious, artifact collectors. You know, they were like lawyers and professors and you know, people that aren't directly tied into a profession that may be tied to crime, but had extensive collections. And by and large, all of them professed that, and I could tell that the obsession with it, based on popular culture, the obsession with true crime is not because 90% of the people or 99% of the people that watch it want to be criminals. They're just so they're like taken aback of how could someone be so cruel? You know what I mean? So, and that was the same thing with so many of the collectors. Maybe not as much. They understood it better because they were just so surrounded by it. And maybe you would think they were a little jaded because, you know, like in any collection, you're trying to top your next piece. So, you know, you start to get a little jaded. But a lot of the collectors, and this is really true, and once again, I don't know if it's a spin or whatever, they said, I bet you, anybody that criticizes me and says, oh, this and this and this, I bet you I can name and know more about each one of these person's victims than any of you know. You know what I mean? So it really is something that, you know, they try, you know, to keep it, you know, ethical in a sense that it not to exploit, you know. So
do you find that a lot of them have mainly like one crime that they are obsessed over, or is they're just very interested in various ones?
You know what? Do you collect anything?
No.
Okay, so what happened?
I don't have space for it in my tiny apartment.
Right. You know what happens is when you start to collect anything, doesn't even have to be oddities, your collection is very broad. And then you realize, oh, I like this. I like this. And then you just start shrinking. And then you start to focus on something. And that's kind of like what happens even with, you know, the morbid collectors. Like you'll notice in skulls, there's guys that are very much into tribal. There's very much into medical oddities. Same thing with the true crime, you know. They'll get, you know, they'll get fascinated may be the wrong word, or obsessive is definitely the wrong word, but they'll a big interest in maybe a specific criminal or a specific crime or a series of crimes or a type of crime. And they'll have, but like all collectors, it's very difficult to turn down other pieces, and they'll come across something else that maybe isn't exactly like it, but they got to have it. You know what I mean? And, you know, so it's very few people that just have Manson and that's it. If you were, you know, just to pick someone that everybody knows, you know, so yeah, that, and that holds true for all of them. An interesting thing, there was in Morbid Curiosities, in Skulls, and in The Art of Gothic Living, women are almost equal players in terms of collecting.
Hmm.
See, the Dark Artifacts was primarily a male based, you know, collecting. But
so you think that's just the people you happen to run into that you met, or overall, like worldwide?
You know what? I could only go by what I saw there. You know, who came, the research I did. So I would tend to believe that. Well, which is ironic because women are the biggest consumers of true crime. You know, the media wise, you know, but I think they're more, but they're not as so much enamored with actually having a piece of the, you know, of that crime. And Evan from Obscura, she told me when we're doing Morbid Curiosities, Evan said to me, I said, do you see a difference between male collecting and female collecting? And she said, yeah. And she summed it up very well. She said, when men were boys, they collected. And if you want to use the baseball card thing, which is really before your generation, but, you know, my generation, baseball cards is a big thing, you know, and maybe there are different type of cards now. There are obviously are different type of cards. Guys have to finish the collection. I got to get all, you know, there's 25 in that collection. I got to get all 25 of those, you know, and that's the way men, you know, she wasn't even saying it in a bad way, and she wasn't being derogatory, and she wasn't saying it for every male, but, and I have to agree to her, that's what the male thing is. You know, I got to complete it. I got to get as many as possible. She said a woman, or at least her and not the people that know, they feel that they have to find pieces that work within their collection, and they don't have to have all of them. They, you know, it just has to work, you know. And I felt that, and you could see that in a lot of women's collections. Now they'll have pieces where they, like you mentioned previously, that they concentrate on, but there isn't this hell bent. I got to get all of them, or it's not complete, or you know what I mean. So that was a big difference. And, you know, it's a stretch and might not even be the correct analogy, but like this hunter-gatherer kind of thing, you know, and, you know, men have to, you know, try to, because they think it's fleeting. And like a woman can look at it and I passed on it. I'll find another one. A guy's like, if I don't get it now, it's never going to come back to me. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, so that, I don't know how that we got on that, but.
Who knows? It doesn't matter.
Okay.
I'm interested in everything you're saying anyway. Do you find that collectors, I mean, I'm assuming when you would speak to them, you would kind of ask, like, how did you get into this? Is there a theme and a similar story that you see, or that you even find within yourself as part of that theme?
Yeah, it's definitely it's something that kind of came early in life. A lot of people, like myself, felt an attraction to, like, things did not have to be pristine, and some kind of like appreciation for things that had outlived their usefulness. And in many times it was something that was alive. A lot of people, it was animal bones and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Where it's such a drastic change from what it was. A lot of other people, lived with older grandparents or around the, you know, who had a lot of old stuff kind of thing, you know? So yeah, it's kind of like, maybe subconsciously or unconsciously, you know, an attraction to, but that, I'm not really answering your question, because that would be why you would want to collect old things.
Right.
Why you would want to collect oddities. I really think that comes at a point in childhood, early adolescence, where death becomes, you understand death, and you either ignore it, and, you know, I guess there's three ways. You either ignore it, you think that you're immortal, which for many years we all, you know, do. That's yeah. one of the theories why, you know, 17-year-olds join the Army or the Navy or the Armed Forces, because they think, like, you know, they're not going to die.
Yeah.
Ask a 25-year-old kid if he's going to go out there and he's going to fuck that. You know what I mean? I ain't going to get shot. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
But when you're going early, you don't have to think that. And then the other thing is to respect it so much or to fear it so much that, okay, I'm not going to ignore this, because this is a very real part of life.
Yeah.
You know, and surround yourself with it, you know. And I think that's the three ways. And I think most of the oddities collectors have this fear, respect. There's fear, respect, and what would you call it? Like fascination, you know, with it, you know. So that's why all collectors start out maybe kind of the same, but the ones that gravitate towards the oddities world, it's when this realization of immortality, of mortality.
Yeah. Where do you find yourself in those categories?
Oh yeah. I definitely,
or has it changed throughout time?
Well, I grew up in my grandparents' house. And when I was about 10, my grandmother was supposed to, like, she suffered this hemorrhaging and brain hemorrhage. She was going to die. Mm-hmm. And my mother was completely upset. So there was a pall. My grandmother was going to die a million times. Two aneurysms, heart attack. So this pall of death hung over the house all the time. My grandmother wound up living a very long time, but you know what I mean? Yeah. But there was this thing. So I know that that's definitely one of the things, you know, at that age, you know,
it made you face it and think about, like, what the fuck is this? Let me look into it.
This is, you know, not something that, you know, I can ignore. So, so I think I'm definitely one of those people that fears it. And the only way I feel I can, lack of a better term, control it, is to surround myself with things that honor it, respect it. I don't even know what it does. Or it's
almost like you're closer to it more than most people are. Like,
yeah.
And you know, because you have physical representations of it, like, next to you. And maybe that brings comfort and a sense of, like, maybe I can understand it a little more, or, like, somehow you're less fearful because it's closer to you and it's not so, you know, there's people that literally do not even want to look at a skull. Like, it's terrifying, you know.
And why do you think that?
Why people are terrified? Or what do you mean?
Yeah, yeah, that even that. Why, like, let's say there are, you know, you're saying there's people that don't want to look at a skull, and there's probably a few reasons.
Yeah.
Or many reasons. But you brought up the fact that they might be terrified.
Yeah.
Because why? Why do you think?
I mean, obviously, because we're afraid to die, we don't want to think about it, right? That's, like, the obvious answer. But I think maybe it has something to do, too, with, like, when people were growing up, they had an experience with death. They saw death, you know, like a dead body or something, and it just didn't – it wasn't the way they expected, or they weren't part of the process, the dying process, and it just became this thing. I'm just kind of using my mom as an example here, because I'm obviously – I'm into death and all the shit, right? So is my dad. And I think I inherited that interest from my dad. But my mom is the complete opposite. She doesn't want to talk about it. She doesn't even want to mention it. But from what I understand, it has to do, I guess her fear kind of started when her grandma died. Two of her grandparents died by getting hit by buses for some reason. But like at different times. And we're all from Argentina. And so one of them, the grandma, when she, you know, they had the viewing and stuff, she's, my mom said that she had like white stuff coming out of her mouth or something like that. I don't know if it was like maybe cotton that they used. I have no idea. But, you know, as a kid, you see that and you're like, whoa, like, I don't want to mess with this ever again. And I think, I think that just became a blanket. I don't want to talk here, death, you know, anything related to it. But I think it's it depends on the personal stories behind the fear, you know?
And that definitely is the answer. You're answering it for me. There's probably 1,000 reasons why people want to be around it. And there's 1,000 reasons why it's for each person. It's somewhat different.
But it sucks because it's like the fact that we aren't talking about it enough or exposed to it enough, like compared to other cultures, leads to the fear because we're not seeing what it's actually like. So we just let our minds, you know, go off, and it's like we picture the worst shit when in reality, death and the process of dying, and even sitting with a person that's dying can be really beautiful. Mm-hmm. But we picture the opposite. Like if you've never experienced that. You know, I just had a friend actually that I was speaking to, and she was there when her mom was dying. It was last year, and she was basically holding her hand as she died. And she told me that ever since she had that experience, she's been so interested in death now and is not fearful of it as much and just wants to kind of like learn more about it. Whereas before, you know, she thought it would be horrible and didn't want to look into it.
And it was so abstract to her at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know? Yeah. I'm sure, you know, you and I are pseudo-intellectualizing it, but, but we've all read countless, you know, books on why, and so many of them contradict one another. So our opinion is as valid as anyone's, I guess, you know, hence another reason why the fascination, you know.
That's the fun part of it. That's why I do this podcast, because I like hearing all the different ways of looking at death and beliefs and all of it. Cause I'll never fucking know until we die. Right. Exactly. Or maybe we won't even find out then because we're just done. Yeah. So, but it's just fun to hypothesize, I guess.
Yeah. And that's a great thing about like, I was talking to my wife, I think it was this morning or yesterday, a plane came over and it was so low. And I was like, man, we owe such a debt to the Wright brothers, you know, because look what they started and look what we have. But the point being, so many of those things, like how many people, me included, probably would have been like, these guys are nuts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what are you talking about? You know what I mean? That people fly in a plane on this thing, you know? So I try to make it that, you know, never to discount. I might not believe it. That might not be what I believe in. But to discount other people's beliefs, and in this case, we're talking about death. I mean, how do you know? How could you discount someone's?
Right, right. Everyone has their own experience of it. It's crazy. But funny you mentioned flying, because I don't know if you know, but I'm also a flight attendant.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. And I even still, I'm like, how the fuck are we? How are we in like a flight?
I know.
What is going on?
That weighs so much.
Yeah.
Right?
It's insane. No matter how many YouTube videos I watch about the science behind it, I'm like, I don't get it, but whatever.
That's funny.
Cool. Yeah. So when you, I'm curious, like with your interest in, you know, death and morbid stuff and collecting, like as you've met maybe your wife, I don't know if she was part of the community or not, but what did your family start thinking when you started getting into all these things, family and or friends?
Friends thought it was novel. Mm. My family, they didn't really weren't too interested. My wife has somewhat of a fascination, not a fascination. She can appreciate some of it. She cannot appreciate postmortem. And that's my thing I'm closest to is postmortem photography.
Oh, you know, I love really, it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's actually a story about that where I had amassed a pretty impressive postmortem collection. And like you said, you mentioned about collecting, that I kind of had to focus it down. So I'm not obsessed, but I have this, it's an unnatural empathy or sympathy for like children in distress. You know what I mean? Like I can't like, and there's so many times, like if we talk about like what just passed, like Christmas, it never fails. Like, you know, there'll be this wave of sorrow that'll envelop me because you can't help but think, you know, and I have a son and he's an only child, not that that matters. But you know, he gets a lot of cool gifts. He's not spoiled, but he gets a lot. How many kids are not getting anything? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They get, you know, what they wanted, and we're here like opening stuff,
yeah,
and shit like that. You know, and you know that happens a lot of time. Like so many, like if we're eating like a great meal, you think like how many children? Not that I don't have empathy or sympathy for adults, but children should have. That should be a pleasant time, and you know what I mean.
Yeah,
because you got
true.
Plenty of time, you know.
So otherwise, you grow up a fucked up adult-ish.
Yeah,
I mean, it depends. But
right. Yeah. But the reason why I say that is because I concentrated my eventually on postmortem Victorian children. You know what I mean. So that kind of my wife didn't dig that. And one time we had this really big fight, so big in fact, and then she brought up that I took my whole collection and I threw it in the garbage.
Ooh.
And it hurt on two levels later on. One, obviously this big collection that I loved. And two is when you buy items or acquire items like that and you acquire, you know, human remains and stuff like that, there is a sense of responsibility to preserve these things and to respect them and to, you know what I mean? That's part of it, you know. So to throw them in the garbage was like a really disrespectful, you know what I mean? And that,
you know,
so that kind of was a thing. Since then I've rebuilt my collection to a sense, but you know, that is something I will also say. And a lot of collectors, big collectors, I would ask them, is there anything you wouldn't collect? And most of them, interesting say, you know, there's certain, you know, political issue items that they won't, most preferably, you know, Nazi related stuff. A lot of people won't, you know, and they'll always say, look, you know, if you want to collect it, it's fine. It's just not my thing, you know. But one thing I found admirable about a lot of collectors, they'll say, if I think it should be in a museum instead of my home, then I won't go after it, you know. But there's another point to that that's really not interesting, is very interesting. And that is, I forget what the percentage is, but it's under 25% of what you see in a museum is actually in the museum's inventory. So there's huge amounts of stuff that never make it into, you know, that anybody ever sees it. And some people say, like, I think it's better to have certain pieces in my home, not me speaking, that's speaking. Because more people are going to see it in my home than in the, you know, than the inventory of this thing, you know? And so let me just, I just want to say one thing about the Art of Gothic Living and how that came about.
Yeah, please.
No, because what happened with the Art of Gothic Living is it's the culmination of those three books. You know, even some of Dark Artifacts, but definitely Morbid Curiosity and Skulls. And the way I really wanted that book to be was, these are people that live, like these people, I specifically picked and went through homes that they didn't have one room that was full of oddities. They didn't have two rooms. They're complete houses this way. You know what I mean?
I want to go.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way it was. And I asked that a lot of the stuff be photographed from certain chairs or seats in their room, because I would assume, look, they set their home up so that when they sit here and they look this way, this is what they see. You know what I mean? So that's what that book was. We do go in tight and talk about pieces because I feel the captions are super, super interesting. That's what makes the book be more than a catalog. Like one of the most interesting pieces in Morbid Curiosities is a little toy. And it's that little toy. It's probably early 1900s, but they went all the way up into the 60s, where you would press the bottom and the little guy would twirl on a thing like he was a trapeze person almost. And if you look at it, it's in Morbid Curiosities, and you're like, well, what's that doing in the book? You know, it's old. It's an old toy. But then when you read, and there's a piece of paper next to it, you can't really read the paper as well because it's in a kind of an ornate script. But if you read the caption, it says, you know, blah, 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 blah. The letter reads, and I'm paraphrasing, Johnny, this was the last toy your mother played with before she died. You know what I mean? So now you're looking at this. Now it takes a totally different look. So everything doesn't have to be this ghoulish, you know what I mean? You know. So that's what these people have in their homes. And, you know, it's like when you look, nothing is in their home arbitrarily. You know what I mean? So if you get to ask them or to see, you know. So that's how The Art of Gothic Living came. These people are 24/7. Live it. They're not just collectors that they have one room that, you know, houses their collection, you know.
Lovely. I wish some of these homes were like on Airbnb or something because I would really love to pretend that I live in one for like a day.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would be cool, you know. And then there are people that have like, you know, when I first pitched the book, I was hoping it would be, but, and then in a way, I'm glad I didn't because I mean, there are guys like, you know, Guillermo del Toro, whose home is just like insane. You know what I mean? And Rob Zombie's house. Rob Zombie has a really cool house too, in a sense that because he's so into pop culture that my big thing with Rob Zombie, he has the polar bear from the Addams Family. Remember that big polar bear that was in there? You know, he has
that's awesome.
Yeah, to have that, you know? So, that's how all those books tie in together. And I got to tell you, Morbid Curiosities took forever for a publisher to like it. And it had to wound up being out of England because everybody else, all the U.S. publishers, this is too dark. You know what I mean?
Really?
Yeah, too grim. You know?
I got to get that one. I mean.
Oh, no, I'll send it to you. I wish I would have known that you didn't have it, and then we'll send it.
It's okay. But thank you.
No. I will. You know what I mean?
You're sweet.
It's good.
Thank you, Paul. I wanted to touch really quick on some of the ethics or like some of the ethical concerns regarding whatever you want to share, whether it's the human remain aspect or the true crime or whatever. Uh-huh. I don't know. What are some of the
Yeah, that's an issue that you know, everyone the first thing everyone likes – well, not likes, but definitely insists on telling me and proving is that the legality issue. So that's that, you know, no one's going to risk because a lot of these people's collections are literally worth millions. If you could find the right buyer, obviously you couldn't just sell it on the street for that. You know what I mean?
Right.
But, you know, a lot of them have very rare pieces in there, or multiple. So they're not going to risk having something illegal because if you do that, the government doesn't pick and choose and say, oh, this is the one illegal piece. I'm taking this out. No, they just take everything.
Oh, fine.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
You know, and they maybe you'll get it returned, but it'll be years before you get it returned, what state it'll be in when it's returned to you. So they're not going to risk that. That's not it. So that legal issue is not there. Ethical, that is a thing where it almost like it could fall into the debate of what's obscene, you know what I mean? It's different for every person. Now, look, there are things that definitely cross the line, you know, even if it's for willing participants in a sexual nature, there are certain things where majority of people say, look, that's just too much. You know what I mean? Like that, you know, I mean, I know it's legal. I know it's consenting adults, but that's, you know,
yeah.
I think you may be doing something that has nothing to do with sex and it's more some kind of mental thing. So that's not, you know, that you're not using it for what it is. Hence with the collecting. And I see a lot of collectors do this, and I try to, you know, everyone asks, you don't know, but you know, like with human remains, you say, look, this is, you know, this is not going to a satanic cult, is it? You know, you're not going to use it for rituals, you know, stuff like that. You know, that's what, you know, because you can be darn sure that that person that donated his body to science, you know, that's what he donated it for. Now, okay, it's not for science any longer, but a huge percentage of the human remains that winds up. When we say human remains right now, I'm talking about osteological, so it'd be bones and stuff. Those things would literally get thrown out. So by you taking them or buying them, they still find a home. Wet specimens, that's a different story. Once again, brains, body parts, organs, all that stuff. I could see that, you know, I don't have an issue with that, and I think most people don't. Where you can find, and it's a lot based on our culture, and maybe it's a good thing. But like if I drew a picture for you, and I drew a circle, and a half moon, and a line, you would look at it. But if I put two circles with little dots in it, and it has an eye, it has eyes. Now all of a sudden you feel a connection to it. So the fetuses are somewhat of an issue. You know what I mean? You know, so, but once again, that's me. You know what I mean? They're legal, you know, some people, you know, so you're just asking. The reason why I'm doing a personal response to it is because I don't want to speak for everybody else.
Right.
So if you would ask me what the ethical issue is, and I wouldn't even say it's not ethical. I mean, as long as it's displayed the way it was going to be displayed, you know.
Yeah. It just depends on what the person considers ethical or not, essentially.
Yeah. You know, so I don't know if that's a you know, wishy-washy response, but that's my wishy-washy response.
You know? I love it anyway. What have you thought of what's going to happen to your collection once you die?
I think about that with a lot of stuff before I die, not only my collection. And I because I go to, as a collector, you go to a lot of estate sales and you go to, and you see that people are just like, the family doesn't really want that stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, and I'm cool with it, but it sucks that I know people that would really want this stuff, you know, so you're probably best off as, you know, not that you have any idea when you might die, but it would be good. Like my son's into it, but he's very specific in what he's into. And I think it's because he lives in a house of me being a collector that he's become kind of a minimalist. So he's very like specific because, you know, I don't know if I procrastinate, it'll probably get thrown out. If I did it the right way, I'd be fine if they gave it to somebody, you know, they don't have to sell it, you know, just, and then they can go through it and take what they like, you know? I haven't really thought, it's like this, you know, it's kind of a weird analogy. It doesn't make sense, but I find this happening as I get older in my life that it's not true. That I heard that compassion without action is not really compassion. And so much of our life, we go through like contemplating and not doing anything on it.
Oh my God.
Right. And then it's not even a procrastination thing. It's like, it's a prioritizing.
Yes.
Thing, you know what I mean? So, that's a very good question. A lot of people, like you asked that question, a lot of people I've heard ask collectors, and I've actually asked it. I haven't originated the question, but the question being, especially the skulls book, what do you want them to do with your skull? And so many of them are like, oh, I want somebody to have it. Mm-hmm. You know, I really want it up on a shelf. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I could see that. You know, I don't know about for me. I think I'm, you know, either I'd want to be hanging in someone's house or I'd want to be cremated because I think it'd be really rough to be in the cold. But then it came to my thought, even before you said this today, earlier, in the week, you know, cremation remains maybe your grandkids, but after your grandkids, yeah, they don't really want them.
Right. I mean? It's like, who is this person?
Exactly. You know, so what's going to happen with that? So never mind your collection. What's going to happen with you? You know what I mean?
Damn.
So, you know, so
yeah.
I don't know, you know.
Yeah. This asking this question reminded me, I had a friend. So backstory, I am a huge Elvis Presley lover.
Like, oh, my wife is too. Yeah.
Seriously? Oh my gosh. Well, I go to Elvis Week every
middle
year.
Name is Elvis.
Well, that, oh yeah, I did tell you that because he said his name was Elvis. I remember when I met you guys and I was like, what? Like, I was like, okay, this is a sign. I have to have you on the podcast. So anyway, I had a friend who was collected Elvis shit basically, and all her family didn't want anything to do with it. And she knew that she was going to die when she was like 65, and she did. But basically she put people's names, the Elvis world, right behind every single thing. That way it went to the person that, you know, she knew would appreciate it. I did. I think I got like two things. I don't remember what they were. Nice. It was a while ago. But yeah, her name was Vicky May. She was the president of the Tampa Elvis fan club.
Wow. Well, now that I know you collect, sometimes I see those pieces pop up. And some of them are ridiculously priced. I bought my wife an Elvis shirt that was worn by him. So the provenance was a little bit weird. So I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, yeah. My wife went to years ago when her and her two friends, it was Elvis in Vegas, and it was 42 Elvises. And she said it was, they had named them all. It was like, it was so weird. It was a very interesting thing because it was Elvis, you know.
Yeah. Before,
you know, and the movie was really good, though, don't you think?
I liked it enough.
Okay, so what didn't you like? That's interesting.
I thought it felt a little bit circusy. Like, not, I thought it should have been a little bit more serious. You know?
Well, I think that's because of who directed it.
Yeah.
And I think the way that he was trying to do was to almost, and it's, that's really a point in the way you say it. I think that was intended that his life was like just so ridiculous.
Oh, that makes sense.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
true.
And he's like that. You know, that's, you know, I think they knew going in, well, if we're going to have him direct it, it's going to look like this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's true. The feel, you know, as opposed to it being, not that it wasn't a series. I understand what you're saying. You know what I mean?
And, I mean, I liked it. I liked it enough. Yeah. But I wasn't floored by it. Actually, Priscilla, I don't know if you've seen Priscilla, but it's, like through Priscilla's eyes.
That
was way more serious, and I like that one a little bit more. But yeah, I'm very critical.
No, that's good. Yeah. You know,
when it comes to Elvis, you know, I have to be. That was my first. I have his signature tattooed on me. That was my first tattoo I ever
got. Oh, nice.
So yeah.
My wife put a post up. I forget what it was. Not too long ago on Facebook, and he was. I forget what he was singing, and it was a beautiful clip. And my comment was something to the effect of, if he really looked like this, every guy should have just shut himself in his room because there'd be no way to compete with this guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It really, the clip is, he just looks so, and I, you know, not that gay is anything, but there, you know, there ain't no guy who's going to say that Elvis is just not like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful. You know what I mean?
If you say that, you got problems.
Exactly. You know what I mean? So
absolutely.
And being super cool. Like I made a post once of Elvis. It's him and Glenn Campbell at a wedding. Mm-hmm. And they're just talking. And you remember when Elvis was wearing the black gloves and carrying the flashlight time? I said, only Elvis can show up at a wedding with a flashlight and look cool. You know what I mean? Like, who shows up at a
any little thing he did. Yeah. It's like, right? Wow. And plus, he was so tall, you know, like that adds to the, I don't know.
I mean, it must have been insane to actually see him.
Yeah.
Like, it must have been like, what? This is a person who truly is larger.
I know. I'm so into the Elvis world. I've met people who have dated him, who have gone to concerts and stuff. Yeah, I mean, I'm in there.
Like, oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's really cool. So I go to a lot of impersonator, basically. They're called Elvis tribute artists, not Elvis impersonators anymore. But yeah, Basically, like the good ones. But people think I'm talking like, you know, with a cheesy ass jumpsuit and these things like shit. Exactly. Like those exist, of course. But no, there's like really top notch people that are really, really, really good.
Especially the ones that want to do the young Elvis. It's a lot easier to do older
Elvis. One's easier. And fun. That's how I got into Elvis when I, you know, like rockabilly stuff. Like
early I was a big rockabilly guy. So you were a rockabilly girl.
Yeah, I don't like music from now. I hate music from now. I don't listen to any of that shit.
No. I was actually we was roadieing for the Rockettes, Kingpins, everybody. Yeah, no, back in I was in that whole Stray Cat era.
Went to England. Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I lived in London during that whole rockabilly scene. So it was good. And then moved into psychobilly and
That reminds me, I was just at a really cool oh my gosh, what is this thing called? Absinthe Bar in London. And they had a private collection. It's like a museum downstairs of a private collector. I forget his name. It's Victor something, but it's all sorts of curiosities, like morbid stuff. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, wow.
It's really cool. But this brings me to one of the last questions I wanted to ask you before actually asking you the last two actual questions. Mm-hmm. I guess, okay, well, two questions. Let's start with, do you have a favorite collector? Or are you it? Out of all the people you've met.
You know what? I don't want to mention a person's name because I don't want to alienate everybody else. But what I do is my favorite collectors now are people who have been collecting for a long time only because they've done so much of the legwork. And you know how when you start to do something, like we just mentioned earlier, takes a long time to make all those mistakes and to, you know what I mean? Yeah. So some of the older collectors, they don't have to be an age, but people that have been collecting for a while, like you'll go to someone's house who's new and they go, oh, that's a cool thing. That's really cool. That's cool. And then you'll go to someone's house and you're like, oh my God, you know what I mean? But it's taken them years and it's cost a lot of money. Not that it's always money, but you know, not that they're rich. Sometimes they had to save, you know, I mean, a ton, but I do appreciate that being sticking with it. So for the collectors who have stuck with it for, you know, 20 years, 30 years and invested a lot of money in it and did the due diligence on what's real and got burned sometimes. You know, those are my favorite. Those are my favorite. And of course, new collectors only because, you know, and I'm a sucker for them. Like at oddities, like I'll see a kid come up and it's like, my son's like, you know, what are you doing? You know, tell him it's $10, you know what I mean? You know, just just to keep, you know, to keep it going. Not to keep it going, but it's they don't have money and, you know.
Yeah.
That's my collector. The youngest collector who's new to it and the person that's paid their dues.
Love it. You know what I mean? So favorite kind of like morbid curiosity museums that you've been to?
You know what? I don't go to a lot of them, and that's an interesting point because I find that's why all my books, I could have made my books so much easier and then be institutions or museums. My thing is private collectors. You know what I mean? So that's big. And of course, the Mutter, Muter, however you want to pronounce it, that's always cool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, House of Death, Museum of Death was interesting. Have you been there?
Yeah, in LA?
Yeah. Now, I'll ask you a question. Was there any there? And a few people have agreed with me on this, and I won't tell you what it was. And see if it was there anything in that museum, and to, maybe it's not there anymore, that upset you when that kind of like freaked you out?
No.
You know what freaked me out was, and I don't know if they did. They have the Polaroids of the people naked, the man and the woman naked, killing that guy. And like,
I don't know. I don't remember that.
I think you would have remembered if you saw it. It was like these people had killed this guy in like the 70s, like, or and like they were all covered in blood and they were like cutting up and they were taking Polaroids of themselves with it. And it was just like, this is just, that leads me to a thing where I always ask people, what's the craziest thing they've ever had? And the weirdest thing that I've ever heard someone say that they had, or something that, you wouldn't buy it, you know, because it's just too creepy. And somebody told me it was no longer active because of the age, but they had a vial of of HIV positive blood.
What the fuck?
I know.
I know. Wow. That's, okay.
Yeah. I thought that was like,
That's interesting. Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. That I thought was, that's pretty insane to have.
That's cool. Well, cool and not cool. I don't know. Exactly. I don't even know.
I know.
I don't even know how to feel about it.
Yeah. Well, that's when it comes to that stuff.
Well, thank you for sharing everything you did. This was really fucking fun. Thank you. But before we wrap up, let's share how people can connect with you if they're interested in chatting and how they can get your books.
Yeah. Well, they're all on Amazon. So if you search me, I guess, by author, then you come up instead of trying to remember it's Paul Gambino as opposed to trying to remember the titles. And the Instagram is probably the best, and that's at Morbid Curio. C-U-R-I-O. So Morbid Curio. All the other ones are taken. So it's at Morbid Curio for that. And Amazon, you put the author's name in and you could look for The Art of Gothic Living, which comes out in July.
Nice.
Okay.
Congrats. Okay. Last two questions. Mm-hmm. If you were to die tomorrow, how would you like to be remembered?
So briefly thinking about this, not very poignant, my response, I would like to be thought of as someone who was a nice guy, but more importantly, hopefully a very good father. So that I would hope my son thinks that dad was a good guy.
We'll talk to Elvis and confirm.
Yeah.
Cool. If you could compile all the knowledge and wisdom that you've gained throughout your life into a message to share with the world, what would that message be?
Yeah. I don't know. I think I do. I say this all the time, especially to my son and my wife and stuff like that, or people. And that is, and I think now we can see that more than ever, is that, and it's funny that you use the word, all the wisdom, you know, to the world. I think the thing is that you cannot control the world. So the best thing to try to do is control, I so believe this now, is to control your little world.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's what you really got to, you know, whoever's going to run for president, who's ever going to be doing this, whatever they're going to raise the taxes, whatever, you got to be able to just live within your life that kind of stuff doesn't crush you, because you have no control over that. If your life is going to be destroyed because who becomes the president? Now, there are bad presidents, and I'm not going to say Trump or Biden, but they both suck in terms of any, whatever, so you have no control over that. So please don't live a life where whoever wins that is, or if the taxes go up, that crushes you, or if this, you know what I mean? You know,
yeah.
I mean, things like healthcare and stuff like that, that you have, but try to make it that you don't have control over your own health. You know, things happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Try to put yourself in a situation, where you can stay healthy, where you can stay happy, where you can stay without having to rely. Maybe, you could not even rely on your family. If your family wants to make you happy, that's fine. But I find myself living in an own little world where, I always tell everybody I'm not egotistical, and I don't believe I am, because I don't really want credit. I am not egotistical. I don't really want credit. But what I did, and I always did this in film school and throughout everything, is that when I ever created a project, if you didn't like it, I felt that you didn't get it. You didn't get what I was trying to say. That's why you didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a coping mechanism. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you shouldn't have got it. Maybe that wasn't your thing.
And it wasn't there.
Yeah. So I don't have to please everyone. You know what I mean? Just yourself. And, believe me, I'm not trying to be any kind of philosopher or anything. But really, I mean, I see so many people influenced by things that they have no control over. It's devastating. And you can't control over it. And they fixate on it. And that doesn't mean you have to be wealthy. That just means you have to know what you can afford, what you could live with, what your parameters are and everything,
Yeah.
Once again, it's really easy to say and stuff. But, if that could happen, that would be great for everyone. If they could just,
I agree. Yeah. There would be less, actually, I don't even know, but less drama.
You know what? But you wouldn't even have to know. That's the whole point, because you would be in your own thing.
True, true, true. Damn, you know, you're right. See, I'm fucking up the message already.
No, because that's the thing. No, you're not. Yeah. And I agree. But I think what would happen is that it'd be symbiotic, you know.
Right.
You were this bubble, this positive bubble that's walking around and it collides with this one. And that one's fine with itself and you're fine with yourself. And that one's fine. So everyone's kind of fine with themselves.
Yeah.
And you're not asking that person, oh, look at me, love me, you know, understand me. You're just like, oh, that's what you do. That's what I do. You don't hurt me. I don't hurt you. All right, let's move to the next, you know?
Right.
That would be great. You know what I mean? So that would be good.
I love that. Thank you, Paul. This was lovely.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you so much for asking me. It was so great. Yay. Just to meet you there. And then you're like, hey, you want to do that? I was like, yes, I would love to do it. I would love to do it. You didn't have to ask me, so.
If you enjoyed today's episode and need another dose of death, dying, and the afterlife, subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to follow along on the gram, you can find me on Instagram @conversationsondeath. Until next time.